Eager to hear his history, I begged him to go on and tell it. He gladly complied, though at the time I but ill comprehended not a few of his words, yet subsequent disclosures, when I had become more familiar with his phraseology, now enable me to present the whole story, such as it may prove in the mere skeleton I give. Moby Dick by Herman Melville. Welcome back to Critical Mass Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Social Impact at UVU, located on the first floor of the Student Center, right across from the ballroom. This is your official invitation to come say hello and see for yourself what we're all about. I'm Danny, a student leader at the center, and I'll be your host this year. Now, in physics, the term critical mass refers to the minimum amount of material needed to spark a chemical reaction. In social impact language, we use the term critical mass to talk about the minimum number of people we need in order to create social change, or even the initial spark that starts a social movement. But assuming that number is more than one, and it usually is, how do we build a community capable of starting and sustaining positive social change? Critical Mass Season 2, Critical Connections, seeks to answer that question. We identify a community, find out who some key players are, and then try to do two things: trace how those connections were made, and in the process, build new ones. But much as I'd love to, it's impossible for me to actually bring all you listeners along with me throughout this process. You can't be here as I email back and forth with a potential interviewee or sit with me in meetings when I discuss narrative building and themes. And honestly, I don't think that would be very good or useful for any of us. If you are interested in making those kinds of connections, I highly recommend starting your own project. Or, hell, apply to the Community Engaged Learning and Research Fellow position at the Center for Social Impact. Back to my main point, though. In some ways, the very purpose of this podcast is defeated by the very constraints that make it possible. And there's nothing I can do about most of that. But there is one thing I can do, which is give you access to the full interviews. So welcome to Critical Mass bonus episodes. Every interview I conduct will be released in full throughout each month. And without further ado, I'll let the interviewee introduce themselves.
My name is Dr. Hillary Hungerford. I'm an associate professor in Department of Earth Science. I go by she, her pronouns. I've been at UVU since 2015. It's been a really great place. I teach classes on sustainability, climate change, a lot of kind of environmental issues. I'm really passionate about finding the places where politics and environment intersect. So we talk a lot about that in all my classes.
All right, thank you. I asked you to bring a poem, quote, or to describe a piece of art that you find impactful. Can you tell me what you brought, describe it, and then tell me why it matters to you?
Yeah. So I didn't bring this because it's really big, but it's hanging in my bedroom at home, and it's a cross stitch of a little mama deer and a baby deer that my mom did in probably the 1970s, a few years before I was born. And I just really love looking at it and thinking about just all the love and labor that went into it. Like, every stitch is by hand and must have just taken her hours and hours. And it's just such a beautiful, like, peaceful scene.
I love that. It's always unique, right? Even if you are like following a pattern or something, like the specific color of thread, the stitch, where you put it, it's always going to be a little bit different.
Yeah. And it's something I really like that is like an immediate thing, like, I did this. A real challenge with environmental work and climate change work or work on the Great Salt Lake is it's a long road. And you don't a lot of times see progress. You can't measure progress in, you know, months a lot of times. It's usually years or decades or longer. So it's really nice to have something like, okay, I made this beautiful thing. Like, I did this. I have something to show for it and something that just is like makes me happy at the end of the day.
Thank you so much for sharing that, especially that connection to being able to see the progress, especially with like the Great Salt Lake specifically, which is what we're going to be getting into in a moment. But I think there is there's really something there. You know, it can be difficult to think to yourself, well, I'm going to put in all of this work and I'm not going to see any of the benefits. This is something that if it works, it will be for generation. You know, after I'm gone, it'll be a benefit to people that I will never meet. And it's sometimes it can be hard to have enough love for, I guess, those people that are kind of faceless and don't really feel real, but they're gonna be real at some point. Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit more about your work and research, especially as it relates to your position as faculty here at UVU?
So my work over the last 10 years has really looked at water conservation issues in dry land areas. It was first in West Africa. I really looked at urban water issues. There's a lot of cities where, you know, maybe half the people still don't have access to water inside their homes. So I was really curious about kind of the environmental context of that, like surface water, groundwater, and then distribution. Like, how does the system work? Why do some people have water? Why do some not? So I did a lot of survey work and interview work in different cities in West Africa, and that was so much fun. I got to take students actually to Senegal. I got to take UVU students there, and we did some work on environmental quality in a poor neighborhood. It was so satisfying. And then really COVID kind of helped me focus my work more on Utah. And that has been really gratifying. So I'm a really value community. That's just something that's really important to me. And I try to get involved in my communities wherever I am. So when I moved here in 2015, you know, I was like, okay, I got to find ways to get involved. I need to find local issues I can work on. So I started working on water conservation, especially around household landscaping practices. Because if we look at like household municipal water use, up to 75 to 80% of our water is in our cities is used to water grass. That is bananas to me. That like just does not make any sense. Having just like this big giant pointless lawn. I just don't get it. And I mean, I guess they're pretty in some ways, but like to get even to that pretty emerald green is so much inputs of fertilizer and pesticides. And so when we bought our house here in Orem, I was like, I just can't do this. I can't do this. So it got me really curious. And I also learned like, oh, it's actually pretty hard to do other things. Like where I live in this old house from the 50s, it has this giant yard. And as I've been changing it, I've been like, this is really hard. And I know, like, I have this social capital, I have education, and I can figure out how to do things. But, like, and it's expensive. So, like, why is this? Why does it have to be this way? And then looking at people who have made changes, I want to try to see what motivates them. Is it, like, a knowledge of climate change? Is it a theology of the earth? Is it something like about family? Like, what is it that's motivating people to make this change when it's actually really hard? And like, how can we get more people to try to do that? So that's a lot of what I'm working on now with landscaping, but on also Utah Lake a little bit too. And that's kind of my connection, I guess, into the Great Salt Lake is looking at Utah Lake, perceptions, water quality issues, all the kind of political intersections with those things. And actually, I was really lucky enough to be appointed by Governor Cox to serve on the Utah Lake Authority. And I've done that for almost 18 months, I guess. I feel really grateful for an opportunity to like actually make a difference for this giant lake that we have in Utah Valley that a lot of people don't even think about. Yeah, that's Utah Lake. I know we're talking about something different, but they're connected.
It's funny because I'm from California and my knowledge of Utah is pretty limited. I've been here for a couple of years now, but and I do know that, you know, all these things are connected. Like I know it in my head, I think, right? Yes. But really understanding the way, you know, Utah Lake, the Great Salt Lake, all these things come together to form Utah's ecology and the way that affects other parts of the world too. But
Absolutely. And that's
what we'll talk about. Articles from the New York Times, the Salt Lake Tribune, and the Washington Post have all reported that the Great Salt Lake is on the verge of ecological disaster, with the lives of the plants, animals, and people who depend on the lake all threatened one way or another. Could you explain a little bit about what's going on with the Great Salt Lake?
Yes, the Great Salt Lake is a really interesting ecosystem. If you kind of take a step back and just think about how watersheds work, watersheds are basically like, you know, all the, if a raindrop falls somewhere, where is it going to go eventually? Like, how are the rivers, lakes, everything connected? And water is always like trying to find its endpoint, whether it's rain or snow or whatever, like it always is trying to find its endpoint. Most of the time it goes to the ocean, but not here. We have an interior drainage basin in the Great Basin. So Utah, parts of Nevada, but really mostly Utah. Okay, not all the state of the far, like, eastern part of our state is part of the Colorado River watershed. But all of us along the Wasatch Front, we're part of this Great Basin watershed. So that means all the water that falls here is going to the Great Salt Lake. Like, it all ends up there eventually. That's our lowest point. That's the end point here. And water from the Great Salt Lake, it doesn't go anywhere. It evaporates. And then it's really good for our snowpack. So, okay, if we, like, take a step back again and look at 2022, we see that, like, we have this years and years of really extreme drought in the Intermountain West. Some people are calling it like a mega drought, kind of the end of this mega drought. And we saw the lake fall below record levels. And that was really alarming for people. And you can visibly see it if you've ever like taken a plane from Salt Lake City International. You can visibly see how low the lake is. And people are like, okay, like what's causing this? We have to figure out what's the problem. And so there's, you know, amazing teams of scientists that we have in Utah started looking like, is it climate change? Is it water use? What exactly is it? It's a really complicated thing to try to attribute environmental events to climate change. There's actually this whole field called attribution science where they try to say like, okay, was that storm, is that kind of a likely thing to happen or is that a climate change induced thing? So there was a lot of people doing those types of studies. And really what we saw was at the end of last year, 2022, that the lake was so low and we said, okay, like there is this combination of climate change and this mega drought that we've experienced where we have just record low levels. I don't know if you all remember like a few winters ago, it was just hardly any snow, like hardly any precipitation. And then that makes it so everyone that's diverting water, that's what we call like using water before it gets to the lake. They call it water diversions. So all along our rivers here in the Wasatch Front, we have people that have rights to use the water. That's including cities, but then especially farmers and agriculture and some industry too. So they all have rights to divert water. If there's not like enough water in the system, it gets diverted before it makes it to the lake. So it's kind of this like two-pronged problem really facing the lake, but it's especially made us really question like, okay, how are we using our water in the state? What's the best ideas? Like, and really the reason this became so urgent is because the lake bed has a lot of dangerous minerals in it, especially arsenic, which is poisonous to us if we inhale it. There's a lot of places in Utah that are naturally high in arsenic. So it does happen in other places, but now we have all this exposed lake bed that used to be underwater. But since there's this, you know, mega drought, now it's exposed and now it's going to be kicked up in the dust. And this is just like, now we're thinking this can't get worse. Like we can't let this get worse. Like it was a real like red heron. It was the canary in the coal mine. Like, okay, it's not often that you like see so directly environmental impact a lot of times. Like air quality, I mean, you can see it, but it's kind of long term or like, but that was like, okay, wow, this is wild. We cannot let this get worse. So it was a real like emergency call last year.
And how would you say that emergency call has been handled by the people who hold the power to do something about it?
You know, it's such a complicated issue. And I think that there's a lot of really good intentions. And I think that a lot of people are making progress. But what worries a lot of people is that it's not enough and it's not fast enough. So we had a really, really good snow just this past winter, which bought us a lot of time because we don't have like so much lake bed exposed. It buys us some time to get some new policies in place, which they are working on. There's some really great people, some really great agencies. And finally, there's kind of, I think they call it a strike team, like an organized group of scientists, agencies, like dedicated to the Great Salt Lake. And that just happened like, you know, last year. It's like, okay, that's good. We're finally making progress. Like, but we need to get on it because we probably should have got on it like 10 years ago. So we need to like make these. And I think that drought too was a wake up call for a lot of people that like, wow, our reservoirs are really low. Like, yeah, Utah Lake was really low. And just kind of like, it's easy to not think about water use for a lot of people. But then when you kind of see like, oh yeah, you could drive up to Deer Creek and it's really low. Like people can visibly see that. And that's a really useful thing in environmental issues. Like it can help people be active. And it really was like some key changes in policies that have made that I think will make a really big difference. There was also some symbolic acts like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They donated water to the Great Salt Lake, some of their water rights. And I thought that was a really interesting, it is like a real donation, but it's just kind of a drop in the bucket. But it's this really nice symbolic, like we can make a difference. Maybe other people can follow our suit. And like every little bit counts.
Well, once you see one person, you know, decide to make a choice that maybe isn't in their like economic interests immediately, but is in the long-term benefit of the health for everyone, you know, it's a little bit easier for the next person maybe to make that same choice.
Yeah, I love that. We talk about that in my classes, like you can start to normalize different decisions and then like, okay, so because sometimes it feels overwhelming, like how do I make change? Like how do I impact these situations? And so just in my class this week, we talked about like, well, maybe there's normalizing, like, yeah, it's okay to have a yard where actually you don't have grass, you grow food in your front yard. Like that's an okay thing to do. And it can look nice. Like you can normalize those types of things. So then maybe your neighbors will be like, oh yeah, my weird neighbor down the street does this, so maybe I'm gonna try it too.
And it looks nice.
Yeah.
Maybe there's other options. You know, an emerald green lawn has kind of been the standard of beauty for a long time, but yeah. Those things are culturally mediated and they change. And the markers of what is beautiful and successful and desirable are things that we have the power to affect to
Absolutely.
Some degree. So yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it, because I think a lot of these conversations boil down to like, oh, take like shorter showers mm-hmm. and I don't want to discourage anyone from using a little bit less water when we, you know,
sure.
don't leave the sink on and go into the other room and forget about it, you
yeah.
know, but when it comes down to it, it's going to take a much bigger shift than an individual one. And
yes.
maybe one of those is that visible marker of, you know, maybe we don't need that super green lawn. Maybe
yeah.
there's something else we can do with this land. I've seen really pretty like rock gardens
yeah.
for people who are like, I don't have a green thumb, I'm not going to grow food, which is me. You know, there's a lot of beautiful things you can do with that space. But and that's just one thing, right? So that's one thing that we can do in our little communities. And, you know, maybe the church and other bigger industries are able to make those same symbolic and cultural acts. Maybe
yeah.
maybe eternal and endless, boundless economic growth isn't the dream anymore. Maybe
yeah.
the dream is sustainability and
right.
a little bit smaller of a scale, but a little bit healthier of one too.
Yeah.
So we spoke briefly earlier about the role of agriculture
mm-hmm.
in this conversation. And I think when a lot of people hear agriculture, they think, well, okay, we need to eat. There's not much that can be done about the water use in agriculture. And if that's the biggest, you know, user of the water, then maybe there's no good solution to this.
Mm-hmm.
We were speaking earlier, and it seems like maybe that perception is a little bit skewed or a little bit
mm-hmm.
off. Do you want to talk a little bit about agriculture in Utah and
yeah.
maybe why it's using so much more water than
yeah.
maybe it needs to?
Yeah, that's great. So there was a report by Ben Abbott and others at BYU. He's a BYU ecology professor, really active in water conservation and Great Salt Lake issues. And in this report and other things I've read too, it says in Utah, about 75% of our water is used by agriculture. So sometimes you hear an argument like, well, it doesn't matter how much households conserve because really the bigger use is agriculture, which is absolutely true. Agriculture is the biggest user of water in Utah. And if you look at the agriculture sector, it's not really growing food that we eat directly. It's mostly growing products that we feed to animals, like alfalfa and barley and other types of grasses, like hay type things. And then we feed that to our cattle industry or maybe sheep too. And then we eat those eventually. Yeah, so it's really interesting when people like think about agriculture and also kind of like how that farmer person lives in Americans' mind. It's like this rugged, you know, self-sufficient, someone providing for us, like that we all depend on. And I mean, we do all depend on farmers. But when we think about, like, I mean, if you're not eating meat, then no, you're actually not really depending on Utah farmers. Is there is, you know, a fruit industry here for sure. There's peaches, like stone fruits, peaches, cherries. And we're really amazing producers in that. And there is, you know, other local foods, but most of the thirsty crops are alfalfa. And about 30% of those are actually exported and mostly to China. So then when you think about water, like, okay, how much water is, there's this idea of virtual water that sometimes you hear talked about. Like, we're exporting this much water because really all the water that we use to, like, grow the alfalfa and then it's exported, like, that's exporting our water that could be going to the Great Salt Lake. Yeah, another really big issue with agriculture and kind of water rights, and this has changed just really recently, but I think it's really important for people to understand kind of why agriculture has been a little bit hard to change, and also, like, the importance of, like, being politically active. So up until just a few years ago, the water rights system in Utah was a use it or lose it. So you had to show that you were using your water right and you were doing it towards a beneficial use. And beneficial use was kind of narrowly defined, and ecological health was not a beneficial use. It was not a designated beneficial use. So say you're a farmer and you're like, okay, I'm actually going to only use half my water this year. Maybe I just want to, like, let the other half of it go to the Great Salt Lake. You couldn't actually do that before because eventually you would lose that half of your water. And water rights too are a market item in Utah. You can buy and sell water rights. And I tried to study these for a while, but they're not public data on how much they sell for. You can tell who's selling them and who's buying them, but it's not public record how much they're bought and sold for. My students and I tried to track changes in water rights, like who's selling them, who's buying them. Basically, like, following kind of this urbanization of Utah. But really, this was like a really controversial presentation I gave a few years ago. People didn't like it. I was like, actually, watering the suburbs is probably better because it doesn't use as much water as agriculture.
Really?
I mean, wow, it doesn't.
That's true. I mean, like, yeah, look at the numbers.
It doesn't. And, like, wow. Do I think that means that, like, that's a better use? Like, no, that's not what I'm saying. But, like, if you just look at water, like, sheer numbers, I mean, maybe that is a better use of water. Yeah, but so they just changed the law. I think it's 2 years ago now that you can designate ecological use or in-stream use, sometimes it's called, as a beneficial use. So now what you have is conservation groups are able to buy water rights and say, like, okay, I'm going to buy these water rights and the beneficial use is in-stream use or, like, in-lake use. And that, it's really exciting. So now, like, you know, organizations that have money to do this, and that was how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was able to donate some of their water rights, is because now they could say, oh, the beneficial use is actually, like, ecology. And that's a huge shift in how we understand beneficial uses of water. And that was a legislative decision. So that was, like, our representatives, you know, over time learning about different ways to do things. And whether they, you know, learned from other states because other states had changed too, or whether it was their constituents reaching out to them saying, like, this, I have this idea, this is something I'm concerned. It's probably like a mix of a lot of things. And also they heard their constituents, like, that this is a really big issue for us. So it's easy to think, like, oh, it doesn't matter. I don't, like, maybe if you don't even agree with your representatives, like, why should I even reach out to them? But they represent you, even maybe if you didn't vote for them. That's okay. Like, they still represent you.
That's true.
And what you care about. Yeah. So I really encourage people to, like, always be in touch with their representatives. That's how a lot of these big systemic things change. So now there's some state agencies, like forestry, fire, and state lands there. They manage sovereign lands in the state of Utah. So they're actually the ones that kind of manage Great Salt Lake and Utah Lake in some ways. I don't know. It's complicated. But they really, like, manage them for our benefit. So now they're developing some, like, permitting for mining of lithium on the Great Salt Lake, which is, you know, also, like, It has to be done carefully, but they're doing this because they want to, like, they see it as this huge potential economic boon that they can buy water rights with that. Like, people are wanting now, like, okay, how can we buy more water rights so we can make sure we're getting more water to the Great Salt Lake?
That's a very interesting situation to be in and to kind of have to choose how to, I don't know, that's a tough one.
It is tough. And that's like a lot of these environmental problems is there's rarely a perfect answer. So you have to try to find some compromises and say like, okay, well, do this in order to do this. And yeah, just really like focusing on the end goal, which is like, we want a healthy Great Salt Lake. I mean, it's an amazing ecosystem. It's such a unique place. There's other salty lakes in the world, but I mean, not a lot. So it's like, it's a really special place.
I wouldn't have agreed with you a couple years ago. I didn't care about the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah.
It's interesting how my feelings towards it have sort of started to shift. And I think I think that a big part of this conversation is that redefinition of things, right? The redefinition of beneficial use now includes ecological use.
Yeah.
And I wonder what other definitions might begin to shift and change and, you know, like our conversation about what a beautiful lawn might look like might change as we sort of start to value slightly different things. I think there's an overrepresentation of the economic side of things in conversations like this. And I don't want to downplay it too much. We all got to eat. We all got to live. But I do think, you know, talking about how a lot of our hay and alfalfa, you know, is getting exported out. A lot of our beef gets exported out. So it's not even like the beef that we're raising here is all going to us. It seems like maybe we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit in trying to make a profit off of our excess when it doesn't seem like right now we have an excess. We have a deficit and we need to take care of that. Otherwise, we're going to be in the red forever. Before we close up, I have two final questions. One of them is, previously when we were talking, you mentioned an organization that's trying to get involved with students. Mm-hmm. Would you mind speaking a little bit about that organization and anything else that you want to say about that?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for asking. Yeah, so there's a new organization called Grow the Flow, which is trying to like grow the flow of water to the Great Salt Lake, because this is really like we see that this is what it needs. It just like we need more water to get to the Great Salt Lake. So it's a grassroots organization. They're trying to organize a chapter on every campus in Utah. I believe it started with a partnership between BYU and Utah State, or maybe University of Utah. So, they're actively looking for people who want to start a chapter at UVU, or, you know, by the time this airs, if there is a chapter, maybe grow the chapter. And just some really exciting opportunities to, like, study on the lake and get involved in making change.
And are you someone that students could reach out to for information
for sure,
about this kind of thing?
Definitely. Yeah.
So you heard it here. Send an email. All you have to do is search Hillary, 1L, in your Outlook. It's actually really easy, I've found, while making this podcast, to get in contact with faculty there. So I do have one final question. What is art?
Wow, what is art? That's a really big question. And I'm, okay, when I think of, like, what is art, I think it just is something that communicates with, like, your authentic person. In a way that's like, I don't know, it just like touches yourself in ways you might not even be able to know that like you needed to hear that. Like that's, to me, that's art. Like something that opens a little bit of your mind to seeing things something different or touches you in a way that is like recognizes a part of you that you needed to be recognized.
Thank you to today's interviewee for sharing their stories. Check the show notes for a link to the full episode this interview is part of. The Center for Social Impact is located in the Student Wellness Building in SC 105 across from the ballroom. We have events every Thursday, including movie night, the Impact Speaker Series, Impact 101, giveaways, and more. Critical Mass Podcast is produced by the Center for Social Impact of Utah Valley University, but was researched, scripted, recorded, and edited by students. Any and all opinions expressed by me or interviewees belong to us alone and don't necessarily reflect the opinions or values of the Center for Social Impact or of Utah Valley University.